From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The violent police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and countless other Black Americans have touched off a nerve in American society and sparked not only an unprecedented nationwide uprising, but also a re-evaluation of the role of police in society. Meeting protests against state violence with more violence, American police appear tone deaf to the increasingly negative light in which even the American mainstream views them. It is in this context that we're now seeing multiple calls to defund the police, a heretofore unmentionable idea. My guest is Alex Vitale, professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. He writes about policing in the New York Times and New York Daily News, USA Today, The Nation, Vice News, and more. His latest book is called The End of Policing. His latest article in The Guardian is called The Answer to Police Violence is Not Reform, It's Defunding. Here's why. He also has a new piece in The Nation magazine called The Only Solution is to Defund the Police. Welcome to the program, Alex.
Thank you, Sonal.
So I mentioned it was an unmentionable idea, except, of course, folks like yourself had been calling to defund the police. We had interviewed you about your book a couple of years ago. But now we see, you know, the New Republic, the New York Times, say out loud something that we have really not heard being said before, which is that the police receive far too much money and this is the time to defund them. Previously, we have only heard calls to reform the police. Is this a very critical moment in this idea and in the conversation around defunding the police?
I think it is. I think in part because for 6 years since what happened in Ferguson, the death of Mike Brown, the killing of Eric Garner, what we've heard from politicians, political leaders, and a huge swath of academic experts on policing is don't worry, we're going to give them some training, we're going to have some police community encounter sessions, and everything's going to be fine. And nothing has changed. And we're finally, I think, ready as a movement to get beyond this idea that body cameras or even jailing one or two killer cops is going to fix the problems of policing. We need to ask this bigger question about why are we using the police for everything?
So let's talk about how much money the police do get. At a time when the nation is reeling from a pandemic, when there hasn't been enough money to give our healthcare workers proper protective equipment or to test, enough Americans around the country to do contact tracing, to do, you know, anything beyond giving individuals a $1,200 check. States are desperate for funds. Public school districts are facing closure. The police appear pretty comfortable financially.
Yes, here in New York, the police budget is over $6 billion. And in the current financial crisis, they were told to cut like $23 million. But the education department was told to cut $650 million from their budget. It's an outrage. That's why last week, the Policing and Social Justice Project I coordinate called for a $1 billion reduction in the NYPD budget phased in over 4 or 5 years. And similar demands are being made in Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Dallas, Milwaukee, across the country. People are realizing too much money is being spent on policing.
The police also have access to military equipment. Since the 1990s, they have been receiving military tanks and the kinds of things that soldiers use in war zones as part of a federal program that now at least one senator from Hawaii, Brian Schatz, has said he will introduce an amendment to reduce that funding to give that military equipment. And folks like yourself had been calling attention to this militarization of the police for years, but it was sort of an issue that didn't get much attention because the police didn't, you know, roll through tanks often enough in cities. Today, the amount of equipment that they've amassed that has literally turned our streets into war zones, I think is finally drawing attention to this aspect of policing, right?
Yeah, when Peter Kraska did his landmark work on this about 20 years ago, there was just so little public attention to it. And finally, I think really with the way that policing in Ferguson happened, people began to realize that this hardware was not being used to go after armed bank robbers with machine guns. It was being used to suppress dissent, to carry out the war on drugs, and to create a kind of phony show of safety in relationship to terrorism. And the 1033 program, Homeland Security grants, have all been a kind of welfare to defense agencies to get them into the domestic policing market. And this stuff has just all got to go.
We also have, as part of the system that keeps police, you know, incredibly well funded, we have prosecutors that refuse to prosecute them. We have members of Congress refusing to call them out. We have very powerful police unions that have strong political clout. This is all part of the culture of policing in America today. You know, these aspects of which may not be getting as much attention, but do really need to be revealed and exposed, right?
Yes, I mean, this sort of thin blue line politics has been incredibly successful in cowing, you know, even politically progressive mayors across the country into maintaining these police budgets. And part of it is really that we've got this bipartisan consensus around austerity politics that says that, you know, there's nothing that local places can do under the pressure of globalization to reduce inequality or to lift up the bottom. And so then they just, when problems of mass homelessness, substance abuse, untreated mental health, you know, become a problem, then they throw the police at it and define these problems as ones of individual or group moral failure that absolves them of responsibility for the market failures that are really at the root of these problems. And so I think what we're seeing is a convergence of the kind of rise of a democratic socialist politics that rejects austerity and this growing kind of Black Lives Matter movement that says that, you know, over-policing, mass incarceration are no longer acceptable. And that is really what's being expressed out on the streets. And it's created what is this amazing multiracial movement for a new vision of urban justice.
Attorney General William Barr has called on federal riot police to go to New York City, to go to Miami. What is this aspect of federal policing, again, that I think just hasn't gotten much attention?
Well, and not just sending police, but framing this as like an intelligence gathering operation with outside agitators and organized, you know, radicals. This is about a witch hunt. It's about signaling to conservative voters that these protests are criminal in nature, right? And that right always wants to define these problems as crime problems that are moral failures, and signaling that he's going to mobilize the repressive apparatus of the state to go after these movements.
Now, the police in Minnesota in particular have had a training program in place that was only called off last year, called the Warrior Training Program. This is this highlights the links between white supremacist style policing and the infiltration of police departments by white supremacist rhetoric and ideology. And it's not something, again, that's getting that much attention. Some people have suggested that, you know, we just need to have not just better training for police, but the kind of people that police departments hire. But aren't the links between racist ideology and policing historically part of the American approach to law enforcement?
Right. I mean, I think that's one of the tricky things about talking about police militarization. It's not just about tanks and hardware. It's really about an ethos that is deeply embedded in American policing. going back to the reforms of policing 100 years ago or 120 years ago, which turned out that those reforms were about adopting a whole set of militarized counterinsurgency strategies that were learned during the U.S. occupation of the Philippines at the end of the Spanish-American War. So policing has always been this kind of soft edge of military systems of control that attempts to be more legitimate to gain more public compliance. But in both cases, what's at work here is basically the suppression of resistance to regimes of exploitation. And that's very much what's happening right now.
There's been much made of the fact that some police officers, some individuals, some heads of police departments and sheriffs have joined in with the protests, have taken a knee, have spoken out against the racist police violence. And there's been, you know, a kind of joyous reposting and sharing of these sorts of images on social media as a way to suggest that this is, you know, this is the kind of police that we need. What do you make of this? Yes, there's maybe a handful of police that take a knee or join the Black Lives Matter protests, but what does that mean for all police?
This is an attempt to resolve a profound existential crisis for American policing. And so they are grasping at straws. They're looking for anything they can do. They're going to throw those officers in Minneapolis under the bus. Police leaders across the country have said this is outrageous policing, but they're only saying that because of the level of outrage, the need to try to do damage control. The real solution to this is not for the police to try to pretend that they're friendlier or to give them a new training program. It's to remove them from as many functions as we can possibly manage.
So when we think about defunding the police, there's, of course, the natural question of if we take money away from police, what do we put it towards? Some have said, and this is the piece that appeared in the New York Times on May 30th, no more money for the police. And the authors, Philip McCarris and Thenjiwe McCarris, say that, who's a strategist with Movement for Black Lives, say that they want the money redirected to emergency response programs that don't kill Black people. What do you think the money needs to go into instead?
Well, they did a great job, and I think we do need to create 24-hour crisis response capabilities outside the police department to deal with potential overdoses, mental health crises, homeless people in distress. But we also need more preventative interventions. Where is the basic infrastructure of mental health services that would prevent a person from having a crisis in the first place? Where's the supportive housing so that we don't have a homelessness problem to manage with police? Where are the medically based drug treatment programs that should be available on demand for anyone who needs them? Safe injection facilities, needle exchange programs. These are examples, but it includes things like rethinking how we run schools, dealing with youth violence in completely different ways. So there are lots of very specific targeted interventions that we can look to rather than just broad-based anti-poverty spending.
What about community oversight of police? A lot of local groups for many years have called for that, and there's been often great resistance to that. Is that a worthwhile endeavor to focus on? And in places where there has been community oversight, has it worked?
I think what we need is more political power for communities, but the problem with community control of the police, and there are a few, is that it still leaves open this idea that policing, if only properly managed, would serve this positive function. And I'm just not sure that's true. I think instead, let's give the community power over government to demand the kind of resources that will actually make them healthier and safer. And that's not going to involve people with guns and handcuffs. The other problem is that it will produce a kind of balkanization of policing, where sure, maybe the leadership over the policing in poor Black and Latino communities is better in some sense, but then when Black and brown people have to go into white neighborhoods to work, to shop, to visit people, they will be dealing with a police department that's completely under the control of a white racist neighborhood that is not going to treat them well. So I think we need universal standards for how to make communities safer, and policing is not it.
Are you hopeful that this rallying cry to defund the police can move beyond the op-ed pages of newspapers and into the mouths of politicians? I mean, we saw during the height of the immigrant justice movement, when family separation was a big issue, that abolish ICE became a rallying cry from the grassroots, but then was also something that members of Congress began echoing.
So, you know, there are some movements at different levels of government. You know, Ayanna Pressley had a very good document about rethinking the federal role in criminal justice and trying to shift resources from punitive stuff to communities. And the Sanders campaign document had a lot of that language. Many of the other presidential candidates had that language, many of whom are senators. Here in New York, there's a whole new generation of politicians who are embracing this language. Just today, about 20 of them released a statement. These are candidates who want to run for city council, that part of their platform is going to be defunding the police by $1 billion over 4 years. So I think we are creating the political space for politicians to adopt this new approach.
Do you feel vindicated finally, Alex, in talking about this for several years and now finally seeing that everything that you and other progressives have been warning, that Black activists and the movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter had been demanding and warning about, has come to fruition, and the issues that they've been calling for and that the questions they've been raising are entering the mainstream?
Look, yes, it's gratifying. I am in one lane where I have the privilege of an academic position to do long-form research and writing and to articulate these ideas in certain forums. But these ideas have been percolating on the ground in movements, in communities for years. And the most gratifying thing is to see the recognition that they're getting, to see the political power that they're generating. And that's where the future of this movement has to lie.
Thank you so much, Alex, for joining us today. We'll post links to your articles in The Guardian and The Nation from our website. Appreciate your time.
You're most welcome.
My guest has been Alex Vitale, professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. And his latest book is called The End of Policing. We'd interviewed him about it on our program a few years ago. He wrote an article in The Guardian as well as in The Nation echoing the call for defunding the police. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.